welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is part one of That Blackguard, Winston Churchill, and it was authored by Major Mervyn F. Thurgood. The article is excerpted from a booklet boldly entitled That Bastard, Churchill, by patriotic writer Major M.E. Thurgood. It is a blistering exposé of Winston Churchill's lack of humanity and chivalry in war, his bad temper and bizarre habits, and his insatiable lust for alcohol, washed down with a good dose of Christian blood. Decades of propaganda have millions of people believing Churchill was some kind of an English saviour, when in fact he was the architect of the destruction of the British Empire. Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill was born in 1874, the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, the third son of the Duke of Marlborough. Winston Churchill was educated at Harrow and after three attempts gained entrance to Sandhurst Military College. His forte was English, but he was innumerate and graduated near the foot of his class. While at Sandhurst, he was accused of committing an act of gross immorality of the Oscar Wilde type. Churchill brought suit against the father of one of the cadets who accused him, A.C. Bruce Price. The charges were withdrawn and Churchill received £400 in damages. No sooner was that incident over than Churchill became involved in a steeplechase fraud, and he and his cohorts became the target of a tabloid called Truth. In 1895, Churchill and a friend, Reginald Barnes, went to Cuba and spent some 6 weeks with the Spanish forces, sending daily reports to the Daily Graphic. The Graphic was a British weekly illustrated newspaper, first published on the 4th of December 1869 by William Lewson Thomas's company, Illustrated Newspapers Limited. In 1895, Churchill and fellow officer Reginald Barnes travelled to Cuba to observe the Spanish fight the Cuban guerrillas. He had obtained a commission to write about the conflict from the Daily Graphic. He became more interested in being a writer than a soldier, but realised that the army would be a good foundation for political life, and joined the Malakand Field Force on the northwest frontier, and on occasion joined in skirmishes with the Afridis, who, despite Churchill's reports of heavy fighting, only threw stones at the British. Churchill's next military exploit was in 1898 at Omdurman, with the 21st Lancers under Kitchener advancing on Khartoum. Here again his military energies were directed to writing for the Times and the Morning Post. Lord Kitchener was to say of him that he had grit enough but only used the army as a convenience, and could secure postings that would suit his purpose through his mother. He served in South Africa for part of a year from 1899 to 1900 as a war correspondent, and his claim to fame was that he had been taken prisoner and had escaped. He was elected MP for Oldham as a Conservative in 1900 at the age of 24, but joined the Liberals in 1904 and attained cabinet rank. As President of the Board of Trade in 1908, he became Home Secretary in 1910 and was made First Lord of the Admiralty in 1911, which of course brings to mind Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore. Stick close to your desk and never go to sea, and you may be the leader of the Queen's Navy. Winston Churchill rather enjoyed war. In July 1914, as Britain prepared for the oncoming catastrophe, Churchill, at the time the First Lord of the Admiralty, wrote to his wife, "I am interested, geared up and happy. Is it not horrible to be built like that?" And in 1916, in a letter to David Lord George's daughter, Churchill admitted, "I think a curse should rest on me, because I love this war. I know it's smashing and shattering the lives of thousands every moment, and yet I can't help it. I enjoy every second of it." In his capacity as First Lord of the Admiralty, he devised a plan to bring support to the Russians by opening up the Dardanelles by the army, using mostly colonials, the Anzacs. The attack on Gallipoli was a disaster, and it was here that Churchill blotted his copybook. But far deeper and more sinister was his role in the sinking of the Lusitania on May 8, 1915. Churchill was linked with the then Undersecretary of the US Navy, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in a conspiracy to bring America into the war by sinking the Cunard liner out of New York. Twice, the German embassy in New York issued warnings in the US press against sailing on the ill-fated liner, which the Germans claimed was carrying contraband and munitions and was being converted into an armed merchant ship. It was also known that it would be carrying about one company of soldiers, field guns, and ammunition. The RMS Lusitania, named after the old Roman Empire's name for the province which is now called Portugal, RMS Lusitania was a British ocean liner, the holder of the Blue Riband, and briefly the world's biggest ship. She was launched by the Cunard Line in 1907, at a time of fierce competition for the North Atlantic trade. In 1915, she was hit by one torpedo by a German U-boat. Subsequently, the munitions the ship was secretly carrying exploded, causing the deaths of 1,198 passengers and crew. On the 17th of April 1915, Lusitania left Liverpool on her 201st transatlantic voyage, arriving in New York on the 24th of April. A group of German Americans, hoping to avoid controversy if Lusitania were attacked by a U-boat, discussed their concerns with a representative of the German embassy. The embassy decided to warn passengers before her next crossing not to sail aboard the Lusitania. The Imperial German Embassy placed a warning advertisement in 50 American newspapers, including those in New York. The notice said, "Travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies and Great Britain and her allies. That the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles. That in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or any of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travellers sailing in the war zone on the ships of Great Britain or her allies do so at their own risk. Signed, the Imperial German Embassy, Washington, D.C., April 22, 1915. It was normal procedure for all such liners to be escorted from the south coast of Ireland to Liverpool by at least one light cruiser and two destroyers. On the 6th of May, Captain W.T. Turner received warning of submarines along the south coast of Ireland, and he expected to be diverted around the north coast of Ireland. But the First Lord of the Admiralty didn't normally concern himself with such things, but Churchill issued orders that the Lusitania was not to be escorted to Liverpool. He then left for Paris, and signed himself in at his hotel as Mr. L. Spencer. At 2:12 p.m. on May the 8th, Captain Walter Schweiger, commanding the submarine U-20, fired his last torpedo into the bow of the Lusitania. He witnessed two distinct explosions, as did others. The Lusitania was unsinkable and had double hulls, but it went down in 20 minutes. The inquiry stated that the second explosion came from coal dust, but recent investigations indicate that there would be little coal dust, and it was very unlikely it would be in the forward hold, and that the second explosion could only have come from several tons of explosives carried in the forward hold. By 2:33 p.m. the Lusitania was gone, taking with her 1,198 of her passengers and crew, including 171 influential Americans. The liner went down 10 miles off Kinsale Head within sight of Queenstown Island, but patrol boats remained in the harbour until it was too late to help. The official inquiry skirted many issues, including the role played by Churchill and possibly Roosevelt. Churchill always thought that he had a friend in Roosevelt, who in fact despised the man and his decadent empire. True to Kitchener's predictions, Churchill used the army as a convenience and enlisted as a major in the Queen's own Oxfordshire Hussars on the 18th of November 1915. On his arrival in France, he was taken to Sir John French, who offered him a promotion to Brigadier General to command a brigade. This did not delight the ears of Prime Minister Asquith, and French decided to send Churchill to the 2nd Battalion Grenadier Guards for experience in the trenches. Churchill only spent 5 days with the guards. On his leaving, the colonel would comment, "We don't want to be in any way inhospitable, but I think it only right to say that your coming was not a matter in which we were given any choice." Churchill meandered from headquarters to headquarters looking for a command, hoping to eventually command a brigade. His desire to command would manifest itself with sad results in World War II. On New Year's Day 1916, he was given command of the 6th Battalion Royal Scots Fusiliers. During his 3.5 months in command, his unit was in no threat, and he spent most of his time working on his parliamentary duties. He saw no more of the trenches after the 6th of May 1916, and on the 22nd of July 1917 he became Minister of Munitions. Again, the army had served him well. Churchill's political fortunes waxed and waned through the war, and his attempts to support the White Russians received no support from the trench-weary soldiers, who were now becoming disenchanted with the aristocracy of all countries. In 1922, he became colonial secretary in the Middle East, and inspired by his American mother's Jewish background, played a major role in supporting the Balfour Declaration, that betrayed Britain's Arab allies and allowed a massive immigration of Jews into Palestine. He wrote, "Zionism is an inspiring movement," saying, "If, as may well happen, there should be created in our lifetime, by the banks of the Jordan, a Jewish state under protection of the British Crown, which might comprise 3 to 4 million Jews, an event will have occurred in the history of the world which from every point of view would be beneficial and would be especially in harmony with the truest interests of the British Empire." He would live to see Jewish immigration into Palestine, and on July 22, 1946, the Jewish Stern Gang blew up the King David Hotel, the headquarters of the 6th Airborne Division, killing 91 men who had jumped into Normandy to free the Jewish people. On July 2, 1946, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem was bombed by Jews, killing 91 people. Menachem Begin planned the destruction of the King David Hotel and the massacre of Deir Yassin. Ex-Prime Minister Shamir was originally a member of the Jewish terrorist gang called Ergun, which was headed by none other than Menachem Begin. Shamir later moved over to the even more radical Stern Gang, which committed many vicious atrocities. On March 27th, Churchill tried to bribe the Emir Abdullah to allow the Jews to emigrate into Palestine, but he was warned by Abdullah that the aim of the Zionists was to establish a Jewish state in Palestine and gradually to control the entire world, and the British might have to call on Germany or Russia for some help. As colonial secretary, Churchill got his first indication that the colonies were coming of age and would no longer be blindly subservient to Britain's call. This he would ignore. First, Canada asked Churchill if his aim was to give the Jews control of the government in Palestine. To this, Churchill replied that if they became the majority, as he wished, naturally they would take it over. In 1922, Britain, primarily through Churchill, became involved with Turkey over the Gallipoli Peninsula and the Dardanelles. On September the 9th, the Turks entered Smyrna, and Greek rule in Asia Minor came to an end. The 1,000 British troops on the Asiatic side of the Dardanelles were to withdraw to the Gallipoli Peninsula from Kanakale, but later remained by orders from the local commander. Both Lloyd George and Churchill supported the decision to keep the Turks out of Europe. Churchill sent a telegram to all the Dominion governments to dispatch military reinforcements. The Dominions varied in acceptance of Churchill's demand. Newfoundland and New Zealand offered their support, but both the Canadian and Australian governments were furious at not even being consulted before the request was made public, and at the request itself. The Australian Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, telegraphed London saying, "In a good cause, we are prepared to venture our all. In a bad one, not a single man." Canada would send no troops at all. Churchill never got the true implications of these refusals, and later as Prime Minister still felt that he had absolute command over his colonial troops. Churchill again surfaced as one who cared little for the common Englishman. It was during the general strike of May 1926, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Minister of Finance, and the editor of the British Gazette. It was only his paper that appeared on the streets during the strike, in which he referred to the strikers as the enemy, and demanded unconditional surrender. That same demand would prolong the war with Germany, and his anti-union, anti-labour attitude would be the basis for escalating strikes and sabotage in war industries and turn him out of office in the 1945 elections. Again, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he turned down proposals for better schools and housing for the people of Britain. He would continue to display one of his worst qualities, as described by Lord Milner in a letter to Herbert Samuel. He was too apt to make up his mind without sufficient knowledge. Out of office, Churchill continued to run up debts, and because of Milner's observation, he became involved in libel suits. Churchill had commented to his personal secretary, Martin Gilbert, "Give me the facts and I will twist them the way I want to suit my argument." His comment was the subject of Anthony K. Brown's two volumes, Bodyguard of Lies. Though he had been Minister of Finance, Churchill could not control his own personal finances, and he was always in debt. It was through his drinking debt and his Jewish mother that he became involved and beholden to a group that would eventually become known as Focus. It first began with the president of the Anglo-Jewish Association, Leonard Montfiore, who found in Churchill a perfect spokesman for his association, a man well known, with connections, a Zionist and in debt. Montfiore approached Churchill with the plight of the Jews in Germany. The Jews shared the same plight in nearly all countries in Europe. Churchill agreed to support the association, despite the fact that Churchill had previously pushed for an Anglo-German entente. The Anglo-Jewish Association later became known as the Anti-Nazi Council, so it was not surprising that both the members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazis, and the German people, as a whole, took umbrage with foreigners of a certain ethnic background interfering in strictly domestic German affairs. The name Anti-Nazi Council became offensive to many Britons, and the name was changed to The Focus under Sir Henry Wickham Steed. The change of name brought many people of different political as well as ethnic cultures together. Some of the new members were Sir Walter Citrine of the Trades Union Congress, up to Sir Robert Whaley Cohen, the chairman of Shell Oil. As Focus grew, it recruited both labour and management, Jew and non-Jew, including Josiah Wedgwood, Sir Henry Strakosch, a South African mining multimillionaire, and the chairman of Union Corps Limited and a Jew born in Moravia. Other members were Dr. Haim Weizmann, of whom we will hear much more, David Ben-Gurion, Simon Marx, and Israel Moses Saif of Marx and Spencer, Lord Melchett and Nathan Lasky, to mention a few. It is of interest to note that Captain Basil Liddell Hart, the noted strategist and military writer, was a member, although he was not a Jew. As Churchill's debts grew, he wrote for many Jewish-dominated newspapers, but couldn't cover his living expenses. To make matters worse, he was sued for libel by the American tabloid The Enquirer for $200,000. He now put up the family estate Chartwell for sale. His debts and libel problem were met by his Jewish friend Sir Henry Strakosch and other members of Focus. He was now not only beholden to, but also under the control of this anti-Nazi council, and now all his speechings and writings were directed against the threat of Hitler and the ill treatment of the Jews by the Nazis. Once again, Churchill displayed Milner's observation during the Munich crisis, where he saw an opportunity to go to war with Adolf Hitler. He gave little thought to the state of training and the geographic location of the British regular army, and his only plan was to bring France and the Dominions into the war to fight the land battles, and eventually bring the United States into war with Germany. Both Chamberlain and Sir Leslie Hoare-Belisher knew the true state of readiness of Britain's armed forces, which were in no condition to fight. But more important, Churchill gave little thought to the fact that Poland had been at war with Czechoslovakia for some 10 years over the Teschen province. He overlooked the fact that if Russia were to come to the aid of Czechoslovakia, it would have to invade either Poland or Romania, or both, and that Britain had treaties with both countries if they were attacked, the result of which would be that Britain and Germany would be fighting Russia. And Churchill did not consider the possible actions of the new Axis partner, Japan. Nor did he see that, apart from a strong desire for peace, most countries saw Hitler as a bulwark against Stalin. Germany ended up being surrounded by a mob of squabbling, unstable states, with each containing large masses of Germans. But still, Churchill condemned Chamberlain for not going to war with Hitler over the Sudetenland. Only after the destruction of Germany did he realise the real threat, when he commented to General Hastings Lionel Pug Ismay, 1st Baron Ismay, "We've killed the wrong pig." But somehow Winnie would get his war and satisfy his benefactors. Both the media and Churchill chose to misrepresent Chamberlain's actions at Munich. But by the end of September 1938, the Poles had invaded Teschen as the Germans marched into the Sudetenland, which was some 90% German ethnically and a product of Woodrow Wilson. The rest of Czechoslovakia was dissected by her neighbours, including Hungary. Alfred Duff Cooper, a staunch Zionist and member of Focus, resigned as First Lord of the Admiralty in protest for Chamberlain not having gone to war with Germany, and possibly Poland, over the Sudetenland. By the end of March 1939, Czech troops marched into Bratislava, Slovakia, and deposed the president, Father Joseph Tiso, while Slovakia and Ruthenia declared their independence from the state created by the League of Nations, and about which David Lloyd George was to say, "I cannot conceive any greater cause of a future war than that the German people should be surrounded by a mob of small states, many of them consisting of peoples who have never previously set up stable governments by themselves, but each of them containing large masses of Germans." Through fear of civil war, President of the Second Czechoslovakian Republic, Dr. Emil Hacker, signed an agreement March 15, 1939, making a German protectorate of Moravia and Bohemia. Hungarian troops crossed the Ruthenian border, driving out the Czech units. This mess was played down by the British media, as well as Germany's offer of Slovakia to Poland for the port of Danzig. The news that the people of Britain, the Dominions, and in fact all the world heard was that Hitler had occupied all of Czechoslovakia. Though all members of the League of Nations agreed that the Polish corridor rightly belonged to Germany, Churchill would organise a mutiny within Neville Chamberlain's caucus to demand that Britain go to war over Poland. Even though Austen Chamberlain, the British Foreign Secretary, had said that the Polish corridor was not worth one British corporal. But Churchill and Focus saw it as a chance to destroy Hitler. Polish independence was the last thing on their minds, especially after Poland had invaded Czechoslovakia, for which Churchill demanded war. The last thing the people of Britain and France wanted was another bloodbath over some distant and unknown land. But through Focus and Churchill, both Britain and France, and later the world, would be dragged into a war nobody wanted, and that would solve nothing. On September 3rd, 1939, Britain declared war on Germany, and Churchill was made First Lord of the Admiralty. He arranged to have a signal flashed to all the ships in the Royal Navy, "Winston is back." But there was no joy throughout the fleet at Churchill's appointment. Churchill behaved as though he had been made Secretary of State for War and began issuing orders to the other armed services. His first act as First Lord was to issue orders to the Royal Air Force to attack the German naval bases at Wilhelmshaven and Brunsbüttel. Here is the record. 29 Blenheims and Wellingtons attacked. 10 bombers failed to find their targets and returned to base. One plane bombed Esbjerg, a town in Denmark, some 110 miles from their target. 3 planes attacked their own men of war in the North Sea. 7 were shot down by German flak. 8 bombers found their targets and attacked the battleship Von Scheer with 3 unprimed bombs, doing no damage. They scored several hits on the cruiser Emden, the only real damage being done when a plane crashed into the ship. The marksmanship of the RAF improved very little over the next 2 years. And there is a much longer version of this article that the author Major Mervyn F. Thurgood has written, but it ends there and it does have an appendix. Winnie the War Criminal, a synopsis of atrocities ordered by Mr. Churchill. Winston Churchill planned and committed war crimes, trashing the rules of civilized warfare that had been developed over the centuries in the Western world. At the Second Quebec Conference, September 16, 1944, Churchill and fellow monster Franklin D. Roosevelt adopted the sinister Morgenthau Plan, which would have killed tens of millions of Germans, giving the Germans a terrifying picture of what unconditional surrender would mean in practice. Germans would be robbed of East Prussia, Upper Silesia, and all of Western Germany, and the remainder would be split into separate northern and southern nations. Churchill was convinced the plan would save Britain from bankruptcy by eliminating a dangerous competitor. Estimating that millions would die immediately by inhalation and millions more would succumb later, Churchill contemplated dropping tens of thousands of anthrax bombs on the civilian population and ordered detailed planning for a chemical attack on 6 major German cities. His greatest war crimes involved the carpet bombing of German cities that killed 600,000 civilians and left some 800,000 injured. Note, approximately 40,000 British were killed during the Blitz. Churchill lied to the House of Commons and the public, claiming only military and industrial installations were targeted, whereas the real aim was to kill as many civilians as possible. A thousand-year-old urban culture was annihilated, as great cities famed in the annals of science and art were reduced to smouldering ruins. Churchill and Roosevelt were destroying more than Attila the Hun did. Dresden was filled with refugees running for their lives from the Red Army. The war was practically over, but for 3 days and nights from February 13th to 15th, 1945, British bombs rained down on the defenceless city, killing 135,000 people or more. The bombing of Germany and killing of civilians continued as late as the middle of April 1945, only stopping because there were no more targets left to be bombed. Here is a less heroic account of Churchill's escape from the Boers. Taken from pages 44 to 46 of Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War, by Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor. Winston Churchill had been sent to South Africa as a war correspondent for the Conservative Morning Post in 1899, and ended up in a Boer prisoner of war camp. The story, and it was largely his, derives from Churchill's autobiography. According to his own account, he joined a reconnaissance mission aboard an armoured train on 15th November 1899, and was captured along with 60 British officers and men when the Boers attacked it. Taken to Pretoria, they were held in an old school, surrounded by a 10-foot-high corrugated iron wall. Churchill gave an account of the derailment and his subsequent action in making a daring escape to other journalists. The Daily Telegraph printed a dispatch from Reuters headlined, "Mr. Churchill's bravery and coolness is described as magnificent." The hero created himself. What went unreported was that following his internment, Churchill wanted himself classified as a non-combatant on the grounds that he was a journalist. He used his connections to send a begging letter to Alfred Milner on 24th November, asking that he be included in a list of prisoners to be released, and said that he had asked his mother to write to him through Milner. He also submitted requests for his release on 26 November and 8 December, and promised that, "If I am released, I will give any parole that I may be required not to serve against the Republican forces." On 12 December, the Boer Commander-in-Chief agreed to release him, and sometime thereafter, Churchill was never seen again in the camp. On his subsequent arrival in the Portuguese port of Lourenço Marques, Churchill relayed an amazing adventure. He claimed to have cut through the fencing under the noses of the Boer guards and made a torturous journey to freedom. His daring escape became the stuff of legend. On his own and unable to speak either Afrikaans or Kaffir, but bolstered by the surprisingly large sum of £75 worth over 6,000 in today's currency, he made the 250-mile journey to the safe haven of Lourenço Marques. His odyssey was worthy of any Greek hero of ancient myth. Crossing dangerous terrain and dodging the heavily armed Boer commandos who were out hunting for him, he eventually came to a railway track and leapt onto a train as it thundered past. This must have been accomplished with a considerable difficulty, partly because of his dislocated shoulder. In another fawning account, Churchill is said to have hurled himself upon a truck and after an agonizing struggle managed to remain crouching on the couplings between two wagons. Within a very short time, however, thirst forced him to leap off in search of water. Crawling on his belly, he dragged himself through swamps before coming across the Boer township of Witbank. He was unbelievably fortunate to knock on the door of the only family for 20 miles where he would not have been handed over. After 3 days in hiding, allegedly in the company of rats down a mineshaft, he got aboard another railway truck and concealed himself under bales of wool. It was the train to Delagoa Bay, freedom and a blaze of triumph. That is how Churchill told his story. Controversy hung around his account like the rats in his mineshaft. There were accusations that he had behaved selfishly and badly by leaving on his own and creating such self-seeking publicity. Fortune and determined legal proceedings, however, seem to have removed such reservations. British officers in the camp, Captain Haldane, Sergeant Brocky, and Lieutenants Le Mesurier and Frankland, felt he had ruined their chances of freedom. Haldane's claims were strengthened by his refusal to appear in court on Churchill's behalf in a libel case against Blackwood's magazine in 1912. Despite these contrary voices, his daring escape turned Churchill into a public hero and gifted him a Conservative seat for Oldham in the parliamentary elections just a few months later. And that was all originally published in July 18th, 2015 in the Barnes Review. Thank you very much for listening. There will be more Albion narrations in the future.